Well, still on fossil fuels in a way, documentary movie maker Briar March is a rising star. She is completing her master's in documentary film and video at Stanford University. She's set up her own production company. The first fruits of it can be seen at the international film festivals already underway in Auckland and thence southwards. The Fossil Fuel Connection is a documentary called There Once Was an Island. It's about a remote Pacific atoll. And Briar March joins me now. Hi, Briar. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I think actually getting to this remote Pacific atoll is a documentary all in its own right, isn't it?
It's very true. The island is very, very remote. It's 250 kilometres northeast of Bougainville in Papua New Guinea. And I think one of the most difficult parts of making the film was actually trying to get there. There's only 4 boat trips in a year to the island. And the boat is serviced by the Bougainville government, and you just never know when it's going to come. So I remember we were waiting in Buka, which is an island in Bougainville, for, you know, up to like a week, just waiting to find out when the boat would leave. And then when we're trying to get back, you're also waiting again. You could be there for 2 months not knowing when the boat would return.
I was going to say that your documentary is about the effects of climate change, but that's not strictly true. It may be one of the effects of climate change, or it may not be. And in a way, that's not exactly the point, is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I did start off by thinking I wanted to make a film about climate change, but I'd seen many films in the media already about the issue, and they'd mostly come from a scientific perspective. And I wanted to make something that was more about maybe the human face, or just the personal kind of perspective and looking at actually how people who are living with the experience of climate change were feeling about the situation. And in saying that, I also didn't really want to make an advocacy piece about climate change. So I went in there like looking for a story, and when I got there, I guess I found out that there were a lot of other issues going on that also weren't to do with climate change, and I sort of included them into the film.
The reason you became involved in this particular island is on account of Professor Richard Moyle, who's an anthropologist, now retired professor at Auckland University Centre for Pacific Studies. And he has been visiting this particular island for a long, long time now, studying their language, studying their culture. He took you there, did he?
So he has been studying it for about 14 years, and he's mainly an ethnomusicologist, so he's been looking at all the music. And one thing that's pretty amazing about the Taku people is they still practice, well, many of them still practice their traditional Polynesian religion. So that's what he's been particularly interested in, because the music there is not like the rest of Polynesia, which is mostly influenced by Christianity. And I'd read an article that was about his work and everything in New Zealand, and I was so captured by the story. I think one of the things that really inspired me was this idea of the allegory. I thought, you know, the idea that a community might be losing their culture or have to move off the island was a really beautiful allegory, I guess, for the story of climate change. It's not really a beautiful allegory, but a powerful allegory. And so I contacted him, and apparently there'd been a few filmmakers who had already been trying to, you know, who had approached him about the story. But when they heard about how difficult it was to get there with the boat, a lot of them had already given up.
But you are made of sterner stuff.
Yeah, I know. I think I'm a little crazy, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, that's possible.
Yeah, probably. But so he, because he had contact with the Ariki on the island, he was able to radio him and you know, talk about the fact that we wanted to come. And I know that already I think the Ariki had spoken to Richard about the need for someone. Well, they wanted someone to come and document what was happening on their island. So they agreed that we could arrive there. And yeah, so it was thanks to Richard that we got there on the first trip. And then we actually went on another trip 2 years later.
And took scientists with you at that point.
That's right, yeah.
Because the islanders wanted scientists to tell them what was going on. And some of them wanted scientists to persuade the other islanders to leave.
That's right. So on the first trip that we made, there was like a community meeting, and we could see that everyone had such different perspectives about what was going on. And we were also very confused, the filmmakers, because, you know, we'd heard this different accounts about how much sea level was rising, and we also knew that there wasn't much research actually in that region about what was going on. And even though there'd been a lot of media coverage about it, there was actually not any scientific research. So we agree that we felt that that was kind of problematic for the film, because we really wanted to know exactly a bit more of the scientific facts. And when the community said that they would like an engineer or a scientist to come to the island, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to see if I can try and help them do that. So for the next year or so, I was sort of contacting different people and looking for someone. And Scott Smithers, a geomorphologist, and John Hunter, an oceanographer, both from Australia, agreed to come, which was wonderful.
Now, they are ambivalent about whether it's climate change or not that is causing the island to diminish in size. They say that it could be that the island itself is sinking due to tectonic plate movement. So the reason...
But I don't think they say that it could be to do with tectonic plate activity, but the main thing that they were saying is that there are so many different factors that are contributing to the erosion. Mm. And one of them is rising sea levels, but it's not the only thing. So there are other things like overpopulation and also mismanagement with the seawalls around the island. Mm-hmm. And so these are other kinds of factors that we're seeing why the, you know, we're losing coastal land.
That's paradoxical that the island has built seawalls, and the seawalls could be making things worse because they're stopping the sand building up.
Yes, now this is such a fascinating thing, and something that, you know, we address in the film, and you can see when you come to watch the film. but it's something that is also happening all over the Pacific. You know, you see a lot of people want to build houses around the coastal areas, and then because they're living close to the sea, they build a seawall to protect their house. And then when that happens, it actually creates more erosion, and then they lose their beachfront. And this was happening on Taku, you know, continually. And the strangest thing is that some of the islanders told me that the government actually encouraged them to build the seawalls in the first place. And now, like 10 years later, they have no beachfront. And, of course, with sea level rise, this has just made things much worse.
What we should say is Taku is something like 300 square metres, right?
The island that they live on is Nuku'utoa.
Yeah.
And that is about the size of 12 football fields or 6 hectares. And if you look on Google Earth, it's unbelievable. You know, it's this tiny little triangle.
A dot in the Pacific.
Yeah, but yeah. Then completely covered in houses.
400 people live there?
400 to 500 people live there, depending on, you know, the year and the census.
And what do they, I mean, obviously they eat fish.
They have, yeah, so their main diet is fish. So most of the men in the island will spend most of the days fishing. They'll go out in the early morning and come back in the, you know, late afternoon with their catches. And then there is taro gardens that are on the garden island called Taku, which is next to Nuku'utoa. And in addition to the fish and the taro, when they do get supplies from mainland, they will get rice and maybe corned beef and cans and things like that. But their main diet is taro and fish and coconut, of course.
And as you point out, the problem with the taro is that the island upon which the taro grow is becoming salt polluted because of the rise in the sea level.
That's right. And so we went to the garden island Taku with Tello, one of the characters, and, you know, he was showing us how many of his gardens have died, and the scientists had a look at that, and they could see that, you know, they could see these sort of salt water bubbling up in some of the gardens.
Do the scientists think that the islanders really have to move? Because this is the issue. Should they go, or should they stay and try and adapt to the situation?
Yes. Well, It's interesting working with a scientist because I think, I mean, I found it really fascinating working with them, and I never realized how exciting it can be to be a scientist and, you know, go to these places and do this kinds of research. But I don't think that they would be able to make it, like, tell you, yes, I tell the islanders, yes, I think you should leave, or yes, I think you should stay, because that they felt that that wasn't their, you know, their responsibility. There's so many cultural implications and so many other factors there that they wouldn't be prepared to tell the islanders whether they should go or stay, but they only would tell them the implications of what would happen if they did this and what would happen if they did that. And so I think they felt that for the time being, the islanders could make changes to the island that would mean that they could stay there for a longer period of time. But at the same time, with the, you know, predictions about how much sea level will rise in the next century, it could rise between 50 to 100 centimetres. That is obviously going to have devastating effects to the island because the island is only 1 metre above mean sea level.
And as you discovered, and this was a stroke of luck or bad luck for the islanders, of course, you were able to film a 50-year flood, were you not?
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that that happened because, I mean, obviously it was a devastating thing that happened, and it affected like half of the houses on the island.
It was terrifying to watch, Briar, because when you think about how tiny this island is and you see the sea coming over it, you think, where are these people going to go?
I know. I mean, that's what we were thinking too. And when it happened, we were all in shock, and it was actually quite hard to keep filming. I know my producer, Lynn Colley, was on the other camera, and she was always going, oh my gosh, you know, I could hear her voice, terror in her voice when we were filming this.
And it wasn't that the ocean, you know, it wasn't like a tidal wave or anything. It was just this kind of happy rising of the waves,
yes,
and taking stuff away.
That was the strangest part about it, because for a moment the ocean would be still, and then another huge wave would just come and just devastate everything. And everyone was just standing around in disbelief about the whole thing.
So that was a look at the future as far as you're concerned.
It was. And John Hunter said that it's not about the islands being submerged by water with rising sea levels. It's actually about increased flooding events like the one that's in the film.
Right.
And so it's like, and as sea level rises, there's going to be more and more of these floods. And it's really, can the islanders deal with that every year? Now, I think what then became so apparent to us was that, yes, if they had resources to adapt to climate change, maybe they could deal with these changes. They could move their houses closer inshore. They could build their houses on, you know, stilts. They could get more effective seawalls that actually worked and helped the beach to still remain there and not the sand to erode from the seawalls. But they don't have the resources and funding to do that. So that then becomes the main issue, is that how do yes, these islanders could adapt to the changes in at this current situation, but there's no money or resources because the Bougainville government, which is part of the Papua New Guinea government, doesn't have any money. And I think this is a situation for so much of the Pacific. And for me, it really made me realise that one thing that we should be focusing on is adaptation as much as mitigation.
The Bougainville government has been talking of relocating these islanders. Did you think that you would film the relocation?
Well, when I began the film, yes, that was the idea. I thought, well, obviously that is going to be a dramatic story, and, you know, it would help for the whole kind of classic narrative structure of a film. But when I got there and I realised that the Bougainville government had been talking about relocating the islanders for years and years, and I don't know when that's going to happen.
Also, and it's arguable about whether that's a good idea,
yes,
because they're,
yes,
Polynesian, and it's Melanesian in Bougainville,
yep,
and what are they going to do there?
It's true. And so I realised that there were other options. As I was mentioning, the idea of making some changes on the island, like moving houses further inland and these kinds of things, that another option was.
But actually, there's not that much further inland, is there, Brian?
Well, that's true, but I do think that, you know, some even smaller changes could make life much easier for them at the right now. And I think that, you know, when I realized that I couldn't film the relocation, I was actually glad that I was so open and came up with these other ideas, like including the scientists and looking at these other issues, because a lot of other films on that subject hadn't done that. And so I think that in the end, by looking at the grey areas, it makes the film a little more interesting.
Why are you doing a master's in documentary film and video at Stanford? You know, you've been making documentaries for about 5 years now. You seem to have been doing particularly well. Why did you see the need to study more?
Well, I love studying, and I think you always learn so much when you study. But, I mean, one of the things that happened while I was making this film was that I was trying to get funding from overseas, because we did get some wonderful funding from the New Zealand Film Commission and the Screen Innovation Production Fund, but we also did need to look overseas for money, because it is quite hard to fund stories about the Pacific and New Zealand, unfortunately, because I think that we should actually make more stories about the Pacific here, but it's often that you need, to have local content or New Zealand content to get funding here. So I ended up getting some funding from the States, and I was just thinking about how I needed to sort of broaden my horizons and maybe look overseas for more funding, and maybe doing a master's in the States would actually help me get connections and those kinds of things. So that was actually one of the reasons why I thought it would be a good idea. And also I'm hoping to teach, because I think you can't really just make documentaries, like the kinds of documentaries I make, at least full time. You do need another source of income. And I feel like the last 4 years have been quite unsustainable, actually, you know, and I can't really do that forever. So
You're broke?
Of course.
That's the nice way of saying you're broke.
And just like, it's really hard work. I mean, I love it, and I'm not saying that, you know, I wouldn't not do it, but it is kind of crazy what you do. And
this is a particularly crazy project, right? You know, there was no, how did you do it? They have no power on the island, right?
We brought solar panels with us, and we ended up bringing a generator the second time. We didn't the first time, but you know, after a few days with no sun, we sort of thought we might have to bring a generator. But most of the time, we powered our cameras on solar panels.
You must feel particularly proud of yourself, not only to have made this documentary, but also to have overcome the logistical problems of making it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing feat. It's not just me. I have to say it was my producer, Lynn Colley, and Zane Holmes and Jeffrey Holdaway and all these other people that came with us. But
Zane Holmes actually said something interesting I wanted you to expand upon. Oh. He was talking about the vaccinations that you all needed before you went there.
Yeah.
And he said that on account of your quote feral jab-free childhood, you needed more jabs than him, which was his only solace. Did you have a feral jab-free childhood?
I really didn't see that one coming.
Ah.
Oh well, my mum was she is one of these people who don't, you know, always think that children should get lots of vaccinations. So
you say that in a very cautious way.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, I had a very healthy.
Your mother is a photographer.
Yes.
Called Liz. So I imagine you take your visual sense from her?
Well, yes, and my dad is a painter as well.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, it's kind of like a very artistic family, and, you know, I always grew up with, you know, cameras and paintbrushes and things like that. And actually, I have to say, a lot of the photography that I learned was from my mum, because I did wedding photography with her, and that was just actually a really good training ground for filming documentaries, because and these kinds of documentaries, because, you know, when you're doing weddings, you have to think on the fly, you have to do everything quickly, you have to work with natural light, you can't, you know, bring in lights, and, you know, when you're on an island like that and you have no lights or anything and you don't know what's happening, you have to sort of work in a similar way. So
another good reason for weddings. Very nice to talk to you, Briar. The best of luck. Briar March, who has made a documentary called There Once Was an Island, which you will be able to see.